Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 16th of February, these are our main stories. The Russian authorities have announced that the jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny has died in prison. Domestic and international critics of President Putin have accused the Kremlin of murdering Mr. Navalny. We look at who he was and what influence he has had on Russian politics. Also in this podcast, the UN warns that the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo is becoming a regional war, and what the people of Argentina are making of President Milei's controversial economic reforms.
Muy triste la gente.
People are very sad. I have three jobs and I can't make ends meet. I think about all the people who don't have anything.
Reaction is pouring in from all over the world to the news that the prominent Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny has died. He was 47. Prison authorities in Western Siberia have said that Mr. Navalny had felt poorly after a walk and soon afterwards collapsed unconscious. This was the last time he appeared in public on January the 10th. Speaking via video link from the IK3 penal colony, nicknamed Polar Wolf, he jokes with journalists about how cold it is and how his Christmas presents haven't arrived yet. The prison's in the northern town of Kharp, about 1,900 kilometres northeast of Moscow. It's seen as one of the toughest jails in Russia. Most detainees held there have been convicted of serious crimes. I asked Olga Ivshina from the BBC's Russian service what else the authorities were saying about Mr. Navalny's death.
It seems that they were really quick to report on that death, but they are now saying that certain procedures need to be done to be able to provide those details. So to be honest, not much is being released. We only know that Russia's President Vladimir Putin has been informed about the death of Navalny, which I guess as a detail tells you a lot. And they say that all due checks are being done at the colony. But of course, this raises a lot of questions because Russian penal colonies are known for their harsh regime, are known for tortures being done on certain inmates, and certain things are known to happen there. For example, several years ago, another person, Sergei Magnitsky, who was involved in what many call a political case, he suddenly died in prison. So this keeps rising a lot of questions on what has happened. And also, I guess it's important to remember that Navalny hasn't just died there, as they report. A string of events has happened. First of all, he was kept in solitary confinement for a very long time, repeatedly. Then, on a number of occasions, he was denied medical help. On a number of occasions, he was put into a cell with a person who was ill with tuberculosis, with another person who was especially known for not following his personal hygiene. So it was really psychologically and physically hard to stay in a confined space with that person.
And you met Navalny several times over the years. What was he like?
He is very bright. Should I say he was? It's really hard. He was a very bright politician, a very bright man, intelligent, with a great sense of humor. Personally, we could have disagreed on a number of things, but it was obvious that he was very energetic. He believed in the cause. He believed in what he did. And I guess that's what attracted to him so many people, especially so many young people.
BBC Russian Service, Olga Ivshina. The US Secretary of State has said that if the reports of Mr. Navalny's death prove true, the Russian government is responsible. Antony Blinken said it would underscore the weakness and rot at the heart of the system Vladimir Putin had built. Meanwhile, the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said he was saddened and concerned. Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard has been following the international reaction.
Jens Stoltenberg, he's at a security conference in Munich along with a number of other world leaders. He said Russia has some very serious questions to answer. And obviously lots of other leaders at the conference have also been giving their reaction. One person in Berlin at the moment who will be later going to the conference is Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. He said he's one of thousands of people to have been killed by Vladimir Putin. And lots of people have been coming out with similar assessments of basically who's behind this. They're not taking it as a normal death in prison. So, for example, the Latvian president, Edgar Rinkevich, said that he was brutally murdered by the Kremlin. And lots of other people have voiced similar concerns. Charles Michel, who's the head of the European Council, said that the EU holds the Russian regime as the sole responsible for this tragic death. Other people, so for example, we've had some Russian figures in exile, critics of Vladimir Putin and the regime. They've also responded. Boris Akunin, who's one of the most famous Russian writers in exile, he said that he'd become immortal. That's a reference to Alexei Navalny. And Garry Kasparov, the former chess champion, said he'd been murdered slowly and publicly in prison.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard. So what about the reaction from the Kremlin and President Putin himself? Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, spoke to me from Moscow.
Well, we haven't heard any comment, any reaction yet from Vladimir Putin. Mr. Putin's press secretary said that the president had been informed about Mr. Navalny's death. So we're waiting to see if the Kremlin leader says anything at all. He's famously someone who doesn't mention Mr. Navalny by name, avoids that. Of course, Alexei Navalny was the Kremlin's most vocal critic. He really got under the Kremlin's skin quite some time ago. And back in 2020, when Mr. Navalny was poisoned by a nerve agent in Siberia and airlifted to Germany, he survived, but he accused the Kremlin of having tried to assassinate him.
And recent history has shown it's very difficult to be an opponent to Mr. Putin, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there are Russian presidential elections coming up in a few weeks' time. But really, all of Mr. Putin's most, you know, vocal opponents, potential challengers, are either in exile or in prison. And so many repressive laws have been passed over the last couple of years, well, over the last few years, but particularly over the last couple of years since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, which are designed to stifle dissent, to crack down on criticism of the authorities, and to make it as difficult as possible for a potential challenger to Vladimir Putin to appear. Alexei Navalny came back to Russia. He returned from Germany after recovering from that poisoning. He tried to, you know, change the country by coming back. He was immediately arrested, put in prison on charges which are widely believed to have been politically motivated. So he was unable to bring about the kind of change that he and his supporters had wanted for this country.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. In other news, the violence in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo is causing increasing international concern. Government forces are fighting rebels from the M23 armed group, which is widely believed to be supported by Rwanda. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced, and the city of Goma in North Kivu province is struggling with food and water supplies. Lawrence Kanyuka is a political spokesman for M23. The BBC put it to him that there's mounting evidence that they are guilty of summary executions, rape and dumping bodies in mass graves.
M23 never killed mass people. The M23 was in exile in 2013. The M23 came back in 2023. Over 10 years, the M23 wasn't there. And the DRC, according to the statistics for the UN, you have over 256 armed groups. All these murders you're talking about, killing people, mass graves, are done during those periods, and the M23 wasn't there. M23 is not the one actually did all these crimes they committed by other people.
The UN Under-Secretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, Jean-Pierre Lacroix, has warned that the conflict is increasingly becoming a regional war with what he called multiple interferences from neighbours. This crisis is happening at a time when a UN peacekeeping mission is gradually pulling out its forces from the DRC at the request of the Congolese government. Luke Jones has been speaking to Jean-Pierre Lacroix and began by asking him how many forces are currently in North Kivu.
We have a disengagement plan that was agreed with the government of DR Congo last year. And the first phase of that disengagement plan is concerned the province of South Kivu. So that is not the area of Goma, Sake. In Goma and Sake, we're currently operating with the armed forces of the DR Congo in order to prevent the takeover of the city of Goma and Sake.
And what kind of fighting, civilian suffering, is being reported back to you from your people operating in North Kivu? What are they saying?
This is an alarming situation in an already seriously affected region, and this is why the fighting must stop. We've had an additional 135,000 displaced persons since the 7th of October, and the figures are increasing. So the fighting must stop. The M23 offensive must stop. It has been condemned by the Security Council, and it has massive humanitarian consequences on the civilian. That is why we are not only working, as I indicated, with the authorities and armed forces of the DR Congo, but we're also supporting a resumption of political efforts to stop that.
What would you make of the international pressure or lack of it being put on Rwanda, which has been accused of supporting the M23 rebels? I mean, back in 2012, many governments withheld aid from Rwanda. The US, Germany, Sweden, Netherlands, Belgium, the EU, the UK, and it was seen to have an impact. This time round, we've got many countries calling out Rwanda, not many sanctions. We've even got countries like the UK, which is paying Rwanda to hopefully take some of its asylum seekers in the future. I mean, do you think this is helping matters?
Well, I think what we're seeing is increasingly a regional conflict that doesn't speak its name. We have multiple interferences from neighboring countries, and that, of course, needs to stop. We're not in the business of prescribing to member states what they should do, but at the same time, it is clear that, on the one hand, interferences must be stopped. The territorial integrity of the DR Congo must be respected. But then second, and very importantly, the existing diplomatic initiatives need to be revived. The so-called Luanda process,
yes.
Which I know with a very important role by Angola, but also the role of the mediator, former president of Kenya, Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta, and all those who can help, we really call on them to help revive those diplomatic efforts, because ultimately this is a situation that requires a regional political solution.
The UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, Jean-Pierre Lacroix. It's estimated that more than 5 million donkeys each year are killed for their skin in order to make a traditional Chinese medicine called Yi Jiao, believed to have anti-aging properties. However, leaders from 55 African nations are to meet this weekend as they consider whether to ban the practice. From Kenya, our science correspondent Victoria Gill reports.
24-year-old Steve lives on the outskirts of Nairobi. This sound is from a short video of him selling water from his cart, pulled by his beloved donkeys.
The donkeys, they are good. They are like one of my family members.
I spoke to Steve because recently his donkeys were stolen and they were killed.
So I searched for them the whole day, the whole night. After 3 days, I received a call from my friend telling me that they have been seen, the skeletons, they were slaughtered. The skin was not there.
Steve's two donkeys had been taken and killed for their skins. And cases like this have become increasingly common across many parts of Africa and in other parts of the world that have large numbers of working donkeys. Steve and his animals were collateral damage in a controversial global trade in donkey skin.
The high demand for donkey skins is driven by the demand for a product called a jiao, a traditional Chinese remedy, hugely popular at the moment. But a jiao itself is absolutely centuries old.
Yannicka Merckx is from the Donkey Sanctuary, a charity based in Devon in the UK. In recent years, the Animal Welfare Organisation has become involved in a campaign against a trade that supplies a key ingredient for an ancient Chinese remedy.
The production of a jiao is now on commercial scale. Marketing for a jiao has significantly ramped up in the last two decades to such a degree that the Chinese donkey population just can't keep up. So jiao producers have had to look elsewhere in the world to try and sustain that demand.
Places the industry has looked to are in Africa, South America and Asia, in countries that have large working donkey populations that poor rural communities rely on. Some countries permit the slaughter and export of skins, and some have banned it. Dr. Solomon Onyango, who works for the Donkey Sanctuary in Nairobi in Kenya, says the trade has driven a steep decline in donkey numbers.
From 2016 to 2019, they realized that almost half of the population of donkeys in Kenya had been slaughtered. The demand is so much higher than what can be supplied.
For campaigners against the trade, this is a critical moment. The Brazilian government is on the brink of a national ban on the slaughter of donkeys, and at the annual African Union summit this weekend, state leaders will discuss a total ban on donkey slaughter across the continent. And Africa is where almost two-thirds of the world's donkeys live.
We estimate that every year at least 5.9 million donkey skins are needed to sustain demand. So what we want to happen is an end to the global trade in donkey skins and for there to be no more suffering for donkeys because of this trade.
Some experts are worried that banning the skin trade in one place will just drive it elsewhere or move it underground. But the Donkey Sanctuary's Yannicka Merckx says there could be another high-tech solution for this industry.
What's the way forward for this trade?
Investment in sustainable alternatives, such as producing safe collagen in labs without the need to have to eliminate a product that is so culturally significant.
With the help of another animal charity, The Brook, Steve now has a new donkey, a female.
So nice. It seems like it's very much energetic and strong.
In a slightly windy video message, he stands beaming with pride next to his companion, and he's just decided on her name.
My new donkey will be called Lucky Joy. Because it's lucky. I'll ensure that I totally take care of it with the help of my group members and my entire community.
And good luck to Steve and his new donkey, Lucky Joy. That report was by Victoria Gill. Coming up on the Global News Podcast.
One of the great things about this project is there's been such fantastic energy. So many people have wanted to help, give up their time, or have wanted to give information to us.
The global search that reunites Paul McCartney with the bass guitar stolen more than 50 years ago.
Who were the Black 14?
14 football players who were at the University of Wyoming in 1969.
14 student athletes who paid a heavy price for planning a show of support against racism.
It hit the campus like wildfire.
Some of them was getting death threats.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
It was a complete surprise that he kicked us off the team.
What are we going to do with our lives? How are we going to get our degrees?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
To India and a strange tale of what some are calling political manoeuvring ahead of this year's national elections. Earlier today, the opposition Congress Party said its bank accounts had been frozen by the tax authorities because of an investigation into its past tax declarations. But following an appeal by the party, the bank account was swiftly unfrozen. Our reporter Raghvendra Rao told me more.
The Congress Party this morning, one of their senior leaders, Ajay Makan, he came out with the information that the party's bank accounts, in fact, four bank accounts of the had been frozen. And he claimed that for the past couple of days, the checks which the party was issuing were not being honored by the banks. Now, he called it a direct attack on democracy. Remember, India is going into its general elections in a couple of months' time. And he said that the ruling BJP government was trying to squeeze the opposition. And this was one such ploy so as to dry up their funding. Now, Congress party immediately appealed against this decision to the tax authorities, and they have been granted some relief. In fact, they have been given a week before they can present their case before the Income Tax Appellate Tribunal. And the next hearing is going to take place on the 21st of this month. In the meantime, the party has been asked to maintain a minimum balance of 115 crores of rupees. They've been told that they can withdraw any money over and above that account.
Raghvendra Rao. Argentina's libertarian president Javier Milei has defended his huge public spending cuts after annual inflation in the country reached more than 250% this week, now the highest in the world. He said slashing the state was needed to tackle inflation in the long term, but in the meantime, it has led to prices soaring. Our South America correspondent, Ione Wells, has been finding out how people in Argentina are responding to his plans.
When you look up at the grand architecture in central Buenos Aires, it's a reminder of how this was once a wealthy country. But down here on the streets with people shouting cambio, cambio, illegally trading dollars and pesos, it's a reminder of how fragile the economy here now is. At one supermarket, meat has gone up 30% in 2 months, a can of Coke by 50%.
People are very sad. I have 3 jobs and I can't make ends meet. I think about all the people who don't have anything, many people on the street. That breaks my soul.
But some factors behind these latest price rises are deliberate.
El Estado no es la solución.
The state is not the answer, it is the problem, the new president Milei told the Davos Economic Forum.
Ministerio de Cultura, afuera!
He's slashed public spending, slashed the value of the currency, slashed subsidies for energy and transport.
Afuera!
After years of high public spending, he argues deep cuts are needed and that things must get worse in order to get better.
My refrigerator is literally empty.
Sylvia sews hair scrunchies to sell at a market for a living and says sales have gone down by 50%. She relies on state support and is fearful Milei's policies will make life harder.
¿Y por qué no pueden comprar comida? People can buy food. Fewer will be able to buy a hair accessory. The policies they are carrying out will kill the people. Milei is crazy.
Está loco.
So just up the road from Sylvia's house, her sister Adriana runs a grocery shop. She did vote for President Milei. We're just going to talk to her now and find out why.
Bienvenida.
We live through inflation day by day, and no one gives us an answer. Today we have someone who tells it how it is. We will wait as long as we need to. We are already used to it, very badly used to it. But if it is the last time we have to go through, let's go through it.
His popularity hinges on how long people can afford to wait. Some of his plans have already led to strikes and protests from unions and a backlash in Congress where he doesn't have a majority. We're just outside the Congress building in Buenos Aires. It's 10:30 p.m. and I'm with Axel, a 21-year-old from the group Pibes Libertario. They go around the city at night putting up posters in support of his policies.
How would you describe Milei in one word?
Crazy. Most people call him that, but I think it's good crazy. Socialist or interventionist ideas were the norm. Well, Milei was crazy enough to defy all that.
His fans and critics both describe him as crazy, but disagree on whether he will rescue or ruin Argentina.
Ione Wells, and if you'd like to hear more about this story, you can listen to the Global Story podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Along with carbon dioxide, methane is one of the biggest offenders when it comes to gases that cause global warming. There is an increasing international effort to reduce emissions, which are largely caused by agriculture, fossil fuels and landfill waste. However, new analysis shared with the BBC shows one of the worst methane leaks ever recorded took place last year at a remote well in western Kazakhstan. The company involved says only a negligible amount of the gas was released. Here's Marco Silva of BBC Verify.
Methane is invisible to the naked eye, but when sunlight passes through a cloud of the gas, it creates a unique fingerprint that some satellites are able to track. By using 5 different instruments, scientists estimated that 127,000 tons of methane was pumped into the atmosphere over that 6-month period. That's as bad for the planet as driving more than 700,000 petrol cars for a whole year. Experts say this could be the 2nd worst man-made methane leak ever recorded. But the Kazakhstani company that owns the well, Buzachineft, denies this. It claims no substantial amount of methane was leaked.
Marco Silva from BBC Verify. It's been on the cards for a while, the decline of consoles like Xbox and PlayStation in the world of gaming. With the ability to stream games like we do with TV shows and movies, why bother investing in a chunky bit of hardware? Well, we've had some evidence that this is on the minds of console makers too, with Microsoft announcing that it's releasing four of its exclusive Xbox games to be played on other devices. Who better to hear from then than the man who designed the original Xbox in 2001, Seamus Blackley.
It's business pressures because of the changes in the way that the business of video games works. And also, I think because Xbox has very happily, from my standpoint, become such an important part of Microsoft's revenue, I think naturally a big multinational corporation like that wants to push that software, the games on the Xbox, to become more ubiquitous and not just limited to hardware that they have to pay for. The thing that people tend to forget about video games is that they're very, very expensive to make, and that's just getting more expensive. And so the companies that finance those games that gamers want, and that gamers want to be free, are taking enormous risk, and so they need to mitigate that risk in some way. And traditionally, if you have a game that's exclusive to your platform, you know you're going to capture all that revenue. But as companies look to see more revenue potential, if they can release games across many platforms, that's something in the short term that's very attractive. But remember the old adage that software runs best on hardware. And so for the quality of graphics and game experiences online play to increase, someone has to invest in making better hardware that drives that. So it's really a virtuous cycle. And so short term, you can kind of remove a leg off that stool and things might be all right. But long term, you'll have to look at it and see how it is that you're going to continue to justify the investment needed to keep satisfying consumer demand for better and better titles.
Seamus Blackley. The bass guitar used by Paul McCartney to record some of the Beatles' biggest hits has been returned to him more than 50 years after being stolen from a van in London. Former journalists Scott and Naomi Jones set up a website last year to find the guitar, and it generated more than 600 leads. Naomi takes up the story.
One of the great things about this project is there's been such fantastic energy. So many people have wanted to help, give up their time, or have wanted to give information to us. And so the next step really was getting information from the roadie Ian Horn, who was able to tell us where it was stolen and when it was stolen. But we had an incredible tip come in from someone who was related to the person that stole the bass. And we were able to piece together their story with other stories that came in, put that jigsaw together.
It was at that point that we realised that the thief had actually, you know, lived in the squats in Ladbroke Grove. That was back in 1972 when Notting Hill was a very different place and there were musicians and artists and hippies and all sorts of people living in the flats there and some of the squats. And the thief, you know, took the bass out of the van that was parked directly outside his house. And then the roadies went down to Notting Hill Police Station and reported the theft. The story then appeared in the Evening Standard back in 72. And at that point, the thief realised he had Paul McCartney's bass. It's very clear to us that he didn't set out to steal the Beatles' bass and he didn't know he was taking such a piece of Beatlemania history. But when he did, he classed it as too hot to handle. And that's when he decided to take the bass up to his local pub, the Admiral Blake, up at the top of Ladbroke Grove, which is where he asked the landlord, who he knew, to effectively hide it for him. So we went to the landlord's house, the home above the pub, and it stayed in that family for the last 51 years.
We thought when we started this search that it could have been anywhere in the world. So there are big collectors in Japan. We had stories come in that it could be in a millionaire's house in Jamaica. And yet, actually, the geography of all of this is just a few miles in and around Notting Hill.
Naomi and Scott Jones. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, here's Jackie with news of this week's Happy Pod.
We'll be hearing from the 8-year-old boy who sang in front of tens of thousands of people at a rugby international, and a star was born. And if Stevie and his dad don't make you smile, I really do not know what will. There's the campaign in India to encourage appreciation of the people who do the vital job of waste picking. A potential breakthrough in testing for the debilitating condition endometriosis. And two small penguins who did not have the best start in life, but who found each other and who formed a very helpful friendship. All on the Happy Pod, available from Saturday, the 17th of February.
Do please listen. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randell. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.